We'll just start marching through these bills in the order that they come. Although I see some folks. Well, let's just try to see how quickly we can go towards the end. I'm looking, and that means you guys will have a little bit of wait. But there's no one here for 3048, so that'll be a quick one. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3048.
Mr. Chair, I've got just a couple of things in your packet there. It's two-sided. One is kind of my summary description of 3048, and then the back side is a result of a historical simulation we did. But what the bill does is it changes current law, which directs Department of Administrative Services to calculate the 2% surplus kicker credit for corporations by taking the total amount above the projection, total amount of corporate collections above the projection, if it's 2% or more, you divide it by the liability for the current tax year. So, for example, now if we were to have a corporate kicker after the end of this biennium, it would be based on the amount above the forecast, which is we're estimating now is in the neighborhood of $300 million, divided by the estimated liability for 2007. Which, of course, we don't know. And in terms of the lags in corporate data, we know even less than we know about personal income tax collections at this stage. So the state economist is estimating what that number is. So what happens is that when the estimate is too high, less than the excess amount of revenue is returned to corporate taxpayers. When it's too low, more than the amount of the excess is returned. Because, again, it's based on this percentage credit is based on an estimate. So we have a very good example of this result occurring now in the current biennium. The amount of corporate collections for 05-07, or excuse me, for 03-05 above the estimate was $101 million. We now think that the amount of credits being given to corporations for the kicker credit is $153.5 million, is the amount in the current estimate. So what happened was the liability estimate back in August of 2005 was too low. So we ended up with a lot bigger liability, so that percentage generated a much bigger credit. What 3048 does is it changes the kicker credit calculation to the total amount of the excess revenue, excess collections, divided by the corporate liability in the prior year. So instead of using the current year, you use the prior year. Now, that does raise the issue that came up when you considered Senate Bill 819, that you can have current liability that could be zero or could be less than what the kicker credit would be, so you would, in effect, not get all of your credit. But this bill corrects that by allowing corporations to carry their credit forward until it's exhausted, just as you did in Senate Bill 819. House Revenue Committee asked me to kind of look back historically on how this bill might have affected the kicker credits, and on the back side of my handout there, you can see. Now, I'm not sure exactly what my liability estimates were in August of 95 and August of 97, but I did use the forecast back from that time to kind of imply what they were. So if you assume that what the liability estimate was a year later compared to what it actually was, it was much closer. And if we would have calculated the kicker credit based on what was known about the prior year's liability rather than the current liability, you can see that following the 93-95 biennium, the estimate, the amount returned would have been $181 million compared to $167 million for the actual amount of excess revenue of $14 million above. So it still would have been off, but it would have been much closer than what was actually returned. Because following the 93-95 biennium, $224 million was returned to corporate taxpayers, even though excess revenue was only $167 above. So it would have narrowed it down. And the same thing is true for 95-97. Notice in 95-97, when I was doing the estimates, I was actually too high in my estimate because the corporate profit boom had started to wind down and liabilities were starting to shrink compared to what we thought they were, so we actually returned less than the excess revenue. If we would have used the prior year, we still would have been less than what the excess amount, but we would have been a lot closer. And when we looked at 0305, where we actually do know what the liability estimate was that was done for the prior year in August of 05, it would have been almost dead on. Instead of 15 to 2.5 million above, it would have been 3.8 million below, or very close to what the excess was. So what this bill does is by using the prior year liability, it means that it lines up the actual amount of the credit with the actual amount of excess revenue much more closely. And so, by the way, when the legislature changed the personal kicker and changed it from a credit to a refund, at that time they went back to the prior year, because the personal used to be done the same way on the current year. So they went to the prior year to do the personal, and that has made the personal refund much more closely aligned to what the actual amount of excess revenue was.
But so this personal is done on 2006 tax year.
Yes. But the corporate would be done on 2007 under current law. And under this law, it would be done based on 2006. Or the corporate is still trickier because you have a longer lag on when those returns come in, but you would be a lot closer than the current year.
Did the House Committee introduce this bill?
Yes.
They did. Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
Yeah, when you're off a bit, does that get adjusted in the following years? I mean, if you kick back more than you're supposed to, or less than you're supposed to, does that get adjusted in the next year?
Senator, no, it really doesn't, because the kicker credit is just, it's based on a point in time. It's based on, you calculate that percentage based on what you know at that time, trying to return the excess amount of revenue from that prior biennium. So you never really true it up. Now, by the time you get to the close of session, for example, your May forecast now, I mean, they knew that now they know that they returned much more than they anticipated, because corporate liability was much higher. But they would have known that anyway. So you don't ever really quite true it up in terms of the credit here.
So if you grant corporations a higher credit than they really had coming, they get a higher credit.
Yes.
Okay. But the way it's important that we make it as close as possible.
Senator, the way it would work out over time is, since you can also return less, you would assume if the forecasts were unbiased, that they were, would vary, but vary around the mean, with a mean zero, then you would, over the long run, would balance out, because some years you'd return less than you should, some years more. But that's usually over a very long period of time.
Other questions? We're on House Bill 3048. No one's here testifying on the bill. A little bit.
You want to move it?
I do, but I want to give Senator George to make sure that he would like to also.
Are colleagues coming?
I think so. I have notes that they are. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3048. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2961.
Mr. Chair, I think you do have some testimony on this one. House Bill 2961 imposes a $10 filing fee for certain petitions and responses to petitions. The petitions that are included in the fee are for marital annulment, dissolution, and separation. The collected fees are deposited into a new fund, the Domestic Violence Clinical Program account, and this account is used to fund education for victims of domestic violence, stalking, or sexual assault. Dollars from the account are allocated through the Department of Higher Education through grants to accredited institutions of higher education that provide legal services. We do have a revenue impact statement with the bill from the amount of dollars that would be raised through the $10 filing fee. And these estimates were actually done by the Judicial Department based on their history of these fees, based on their percentage a collection rate and so forth. But they're estimating in 07-09 it would be about $350,000 in collections because it wouldn't start until 1-1-08. And then in 09-11 you get a bump up because you have a full 2 years. It's estimated about $467,000 in collections.
Questions for Paul? Jonathan Manton, Pat Ballerland, Cheryl O'Neill. We have a number of bills up today, so brevity is my understanding is people are pretty supportive of what you've been working on.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jonathan Metten. I'm legislative assistant for Senator Floyd Prezonsky. And I just want to make two very quick points and then let the folks who have come a fairly long distance talk very briefly as well. The first is that this bill would make all three law schools in the state eligible for funding. Saying that because a lot of the testimony that you're going to hear today is from the kind of model program which exists at the University of Oregon Law School. And that program is kind of the model because it's collaborative. It includes a component with legal aid, the law school, and also a nonprofit service provider. And that's the model that we've been able to show has been so successful and that we want to kind of replicate statewide. And with that, I'll just let some of the other folks who are here today talk. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Pat Valoran, and I'm currently the director of the Domestic Violence Clinic in Eugene. And I've been actually associated with the clinic since 1999 and as its director since September of last year, August of last year. And I'll also be brief because I think it's important for you to hear from the graduates of the program that we have here today. But what I want to say is that the program serves not just domestic violence, victims, but also sexual assault victims and stalking victims, and the focus of the program is with students coming into the program that, who are actually taking protective order cases, going into court, and representing those clients in court in a situation where they wouldn't have any other kind of representation normally. I've worked for 25 years in the legal field, and prior to working with the clinic, I've done a lot of civil rights work, and I want to tell you that the work that I do with the clinic has by far been the most most powerful work that I've done, because not just in services that we're providing to the victims who come into the clinic to get services, but also because of what we're doing in terms of seeding the state with lawyers who have a huge amount of experience and also then the training to deal with these kinds of cases, not just in family law areas, but all areas of law that they're going to be involved with. I will tell you that we've served over 3,000 clients since the clinic started in 1999. We're at a critical juncture with our funding. This funding would give us the seed money we have to keep the clinic in place. If we don't have this kind of seed money, the kind of federal funding that we're getting or have been getting up to date is most likely going to go away. So it's very critical for us. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Cheryl O'Neill, and I'm the executive director of Women's Space, which is the domestic violence service provider in Lane County, where this clinic is located. And actually, was the very first advocate to work at the clinic. So while I think that it has a great advantage for the legal system and also for the law school, I'd also like to speak a little bit about what it does for victims of domestic violence, because that's my expertise. I would say, as a public policy matter, making sure that victims have access to civil legal services is one of the critical pieces. It's one of the few things that have been shown to actually reduce the incidence of domestic violence. So if we want to get ahead of the curve, this is the way to do it. And I think this has been very effective for many of the reasons that Pat just explained to you.
And I did want to just mention briefly also a person who's here and not testifying is Gina Stewart, who is a staff attorney with the clinic and also went through the clinic program at Lewis and Clark. So if there were any questions about how this money might be used at Lewis and Clark, she's available for questions.
What her name was?
Gina Marie Stewart.
Okay. We will keep that in mind if we have more technical questions.
Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Jessica Freeman, Stephen Morgan, Tiffany Elkins. And y'all have very similar handwriting, or one person signed everyone up. Morning.
Morning. My name is Jessica Freeman. I'm a recent graduate of UO Law, and I went through the clinic program. I'm now employed at a private firm in Roseburg, where I'll be doing family law and juvenile law. One of the reasons I'm from the South, and one of the reasons I came to Oregon and to UO Law specifically was because this clinic was available. It had a huge impact in determining where I would go to law school. It's by far the best learning experience I've had through all of law school. I mean, it's the first real practical experience. I'm sure you're familiar that, I mean, law school is mostly, it's books, but by the time you're done, you have no idea how you're actually going to be able to be an attorney. And this program has really given me the confidence in the fact that I know I can do this now. And so I feel very comfortable entering into private practice because I've had actual trial experience. I've had just paperwork preparation experience. It's also helped me kind of really put together all the stuff we learned in like evidence and civil procedure and even legal ethics and things that I knew the cases, but the actual practical application, I had no clue. Although factually the cases can be very tough that we handle, just knowing that I've made someone safer at the end of the day makes all the preparation and even occasional sleepless nights absolutely worth it. I'm really hoping to translate the skills that I've learned into the private practice. And I'll be working in Roseburg, and I'm going to be doing dependency cases in family law. And so the skills that I've learned with client contacts, I think are going to be just invaluable to my future practice.
So, great. Thank you for coming from Roseburg.
Hi, my name is Steve Morgan. I was a student in this program in the first year it was open, and that was in 99, I believe, and then I went to work as a law clerk for one of our Lane County judges in Lane County. I worked for Yamhill County DA's office for a year, and now I work in Lane County's district attorney's office as a deputy district attorney. So I may have a unique perspective in that I've seen this program as a student from the judicial point of view on some regard, and then as a prosecutor as well. And I can tell you that it works on all levels. It's a critical component for victims and part of their safety plan and saving their lives and getting out of these situations. These hearings, restraining order hearings, work much more efficiently when the petitioners are represented by a trained lawyer. And so the judges are grateful to have somebody in there instead of a pro se hearing. It makes them go quicker and more efficiently. And as a prosecutor, for me, this program is incredibly helpful for us. Victims come in. We have cases pending. We don't represent the victims. We can't go down and help them on these restraining orders. But we can refer them through our restraining order clinic to the domestic violence clinic where they can go and get help and legal advice on how to deal with just a myriad of issues that they're dealing with in the legal community. I can't endorse the program enough. It helped me as a lawyer. I use what I learned during this program every single day. I go out and train law enforcement and community members on domestic violence issues now. And it's just some general practice. It's immensely helpful.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tiffany Elkins, and I travel down here from Portland, Oregon. I participated in the domestic violence clinic and graduated in 2003 from University of Oregon School of Law. It was by far the most rewarding experience for me in law school because of the practical experience. And more than anything, it influenced me to go into public service work upon my graduation. I clerked for a family law judge in Multnomah County to start off with and was clerking for numerous Family Abuse Prevention Act hearings, and so preparing me for that. And then I worked at the Department of Justice, General Counsel Division, Human Services Section, where I represented Department of Human Services in cases involving children exposed to abuse and neglect issues. So my training in domestic violence work at University of Oregon greatly influenced my decision to go into public service and helped me throughout my practice. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Monroe.
Current funding for this program is from what?
Currently, the funding.
We need to get you on the record.
Could have the DA stand and talk like, and we'd be the jury.
The current funding is through a number. My name is Pat Valerian. I'm the director of the clinic. The current funding is the major portion of the funding comes through a federal grant under the Violence Against Women Act, and the main funding for the program has come to that from that source since the beginning of the program. It has been cut each year because it was intended to be a seed fund, grant fund, to develop the program and then to go on and get other funding. We do have other small sources of funding from other grants, the Collins Foundation for one, is one example, the Coquille Indian Tribe and a couple of others. We also do some private fundraising. But those are all very, very, very small pieces of our budget.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So this new funding source is not intended to expand the program dramatically, but to sustain it?
Correct. At this point, it would primarily be to sustain it. It is our hope to, at some point, expand it in areas that we haven't really been able to give as many services as we would like, and that's been primarily in the sexual assault area. But this funding would be primarily to sustain.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to the Capitol today. Merle Werner? And Margie Paris.
Thank you so much, Representative Deckard. Good morning, everyone. My name is Merle Weiner, and I'm a law professor at the University of Oregon, and I'm one of the professors who helped start this particular program. And in the very short time I have today, I just want to suggest that this is a very smart idea for Oregon. That is, I think it's going to save taxpayers' dollars over the long run. Most of you already probably know the tremendous cost that domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking has on our economy here in Oregon. The Oregon Department of Human Services estimated that the costs are over $50 million a year, most of which is to our healthcare system alone. And the report indicates that this underestimates the cost because it doesn't include the cost that this violence has on our law enforcement, our criminal justice services, and social services, nor does it include the multiplier cost of violence. For example, 1 in 3 children witness the domestic violence that occurs in the home, and 1 in 5 sexual assaults are witnessed by children. There was a reference to some study. I just want to reiterate that economists have looked at the effect of legal services on the incidence of violence in the community and have indicated that it is the best way to actually reduce that rate. That is because people can come in and they can get restraining orders, they can get a divorce, they can get custody of their children, they can get benefits, they can get those things to leave, or they can threaten to get those things if the abuse doesn't stop. So it's a very important part of the puzzle to eliminate violence in our society. This particular program allows students to provide these services, which is very efficient because they're operating under the control of one attorney and they're providing lots of services. And then our students go out after graduation and continue to serve Oregonians all over the state. And they do that both through their pro bono public service, they do it as prosecutors, they do it as Department of Justice employees. So I just want to suggest that it's really a rare opportunity, I think, to do a whole lot of good without a lot of impact on the state's budget, and I think this is actually going to save us money in the long run. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Burdick.
Your statistic about 1 child in 3, what does that statistic mean? You mean 1 child out of 3 in Oregon witnessed domestic violence, or 1 out of 3 domestic violence incidents?
It's the latter. I'm sorry. It's children witness 1 out of 3 incidents of domestic violence and 1 out of 5 incidents of sexual assault, and that's from the Oregon Department of Human Services, a 2004 report.
And from your clinic perspective, about 10 years ago, we changed the law to enhance the penalties for domestic violence when a child witnesses it. Have you had any kind of read on whether that's doing any good?
I haven't looked at the empirical data over time to know whether or not that has actually led to less children witnessing that violence. I don't know that.
Okay. Interesting to figure it out.
Yeah,
working,
it would
yeah.
be to see
if the statistics are just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. 1 in 3 child
yeah.
children.
And we just know that
1 in 3 children.
It's 1 in 3 incidents are witnessed by children.
Oh.
But we do know that the effects of that violence is just, it has long-term effects on those children to witness that.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Sure.
Senator Burdick.
And another follow-up question.
Sure.
Are you finding a lot of animal abuse in this, coexisting with the domestic abuse? when you work on these cases?
So, just to be clear, I actually don't represent victims. I'm the professor at the law school, and that question may be better answered by someone in the field who would know. I do know that oftentimes there's a need, at least for those animals, when women go into shelter to take care of those animals. I'm not sure how much abuse is also being seen against the animals themselves.
Senator Burke's turning this into a judiciary hearing.
I could answer a couple of those questions. This is Pat Valerian again, and I, as director of the clinic, I'm actually the teacher of the students and the supervisor of the students handling the cases. So I know about the cases that go through the clinic. And to answer your first question, just to give a little background, I've also prior to my work at the clinic have been a pro tem judge in juvenile court, and so I saw that aspect of the cases where people who were coming in from those DV situations and children were in protective services because of it. There's no doubt in my mind that having this resource available has given options for those kinds of families that they wouldn't otherwise have in terms of being able to get out of those situations, keep children in the home, and not have them have to go into foster care, because DHS uses those resources to keep families together, help them get restraining orders. As to your second question on animal abuse, there definitely is a correlation, and we certainly have had a number of cases come into the clinic where that's been one aspect of the form of abuse that's used against the victim, the survivor in that situation, is violence against the pets, against the children's pets in particular. We've had cases where the abuser has shot animals in front of the children, and so I think there's a clear correlation between those.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Margie Paris. I'm the Dean of the University of Oregon School of Law, and I want to tell you very briefly how committed the law school is to this clinic, but to explain to you that the law school, and I think I can probably speak for the deans of the other two law schools as well, can't fund this kind of clinic without this kind of financial support. This is the most expensive kind of education there is. As a result, it's also the best kind of education there is, where we have dedicated teachers and clinicians who are working with a relatively small group of students. Those students graduate experts in their field with significant experience. They're able to go out into the community and immediately make a difference. But it's the kind of thing that law schools internally can't fund themselves. We have only one other clinic similar to this one at the law school, and that one is funded through a $1 million private endowment. So I just wanted to give you a sense of how critical this funding is to this sort of endeavor. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean Paris. Questions for any of the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate
thank you very much
all
for your time.
Work on an impressive project. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2961. Open a work session on House Bill 2961.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2961A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 2961 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections to that motion. So ordered. Brzezinski is the chief sponsor. Senator Brzezinski will carry the bill. Thank you, all the folks from the U of O Law School and from around the state who worked on this. Open a work session on House Bill 3048. Had a lot of impressive testimony on this bill first up of today. We had none.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3048 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved House Bill 3048 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections to that motion. So ordered. Senator Monroe.
I'll carry it if you want.
A little bit of a technical bill. Thank you. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3047. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. Chair Dacher. Would you like me to give
them both of you? Yeah, please.
House Bill 3047A creates a county road fund in which property taxes for roads derived from local option levies shall be deposited for apportionment, and it will allow county road districts and the incorporated cities located within the county to modify the apportionment formula by agreement. It clarifies that no ad valorem tax may be expended on any roads, bridges, or bridges except for funds derived from a levy within the permanent rate if voter-approved county serial levies dedicated to road improvements was used in determining that rate. And apparently under two counties actually did have their permanent rates set with serial levies when Measure 50 was passed. And so this bill intends to clarify that under these provisions where the road fund is being created and the counties are allowed to refigure the apportionment for them if they would agree to it, that it still would not impact these counties. They're grandfathered in, so to speak, so there's serial levies that will continue to be used for road improvements. It clarifies the apportionment for roads, including local option taxes, are subject to constitutional limitations and takes effect upon the coming law. No revenue impact on them.
Questions for Mary?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
This gives counties more flexibility if they want to put a bond out to the voters and specify that it's going to pay for a particular project or projects that you know it would fund, rather than have 50% of it go to the local street districts automatically.
Good explanation for a staff member Monroe also in explaining that. Which is two people, Morgan Cowling and Shelby. How do you see it? Rahala? I've never said that before. Could have Shelby testify on the last bill as a current law student.
Good morning, Chair Deckert, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Cowling with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'll keep this brief. Mary did a great job of explaining this, but there are two primary issues this bill addresses. The first is it eliminates some antiquated language in the county road statutes and creates a grandfather clause for at least two of our counties that had serial levies for roads that were incorporated into their permanent tax rate under ballot measure 50. The second is as counties look forward and look to other mechanisms to fund their roads, local option levies is a tool in their toolbox, and we want to make sure that that tool works well. So we clarify that under compression, the amount that would be split would be just based on collected, not unassessed and levied. And also, as Senator Monroe indicated, we would also give them the flexibility to reach an agreement with their cities and do it on a project basis and give them some more flexibility instead of a strict proportionment. So those are the two major issues that this bill addresses. The rest is kind of cleanup of the statutes. And with that, I'd like to say that this bill passed through the House Revenue Committee twice unanimously and only had three no votes on the House floor. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Halla to talk specifically about the impacts to Washington County and answer any questions if you have any. Thanks.
Good morning, Chair Deckert, members of the committee. For the record, Shelby Rahala, Washington County Government Affairs. Just to give you an idea of what this means to Washington County, I've given you a little handout on our MSTIP program. It's Major Streets Transportation Improvement Program. Basically, in Washington County, our voters approved serial levies for transportation in 1986, 89, and again in 95. And the total of those measures was $217 million. So what this bill would do is clarify that we can continue upholding the will of the voters by continuing to spend money on transportation projects, which our voters have resoundingly approved many times. So we would ask for your support on this bill.
Thank you. We're all busily finding our houses on your
right.
Questions for the counties or Washington County? Thank you very much. Appreciate the brevity close public hearing on House Bill 3047, open work session on House Bill 3047.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 3047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 3047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I've been really impressed with Washington County's MSTIP program for the last decade and a half or so. I think other counties ought to look at what they've accomplished and try to emulate it, because they've done a better job of keeping ahead of traffic needs than probably any other county in the state.
Appreciate that comment. Take that back to headquarters and put it on our promotional or the promotional material. Are we in work session?
I just moved it.
Senator George, any other further discussion? Senator George has moved House Bill 3047 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any objections? So ordered. Senator Starr? We'll carry that bill. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3044.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3444A increases the current rate component of the forest products harvest tax that is designated for fire suppression, raising it from 0.5 cents per million board feet to 0.625, per 1,000 board feet of harvested timber. Increases the assessments imposed on owners of timber and grazing lands for the purposes of fire protection, and clarifies that contiguous lots are not subject to a statute which basically says whose owner has made application for fire services shall be treated as one lot with respect to a $47.50 rate that is imposed on each lot. Regarding the assessments paid to the Oregon Land Protection Fund, it clarifies that a lot on which a single-family dwelling has been placed may be treated as a combined lot if it does not exceed 20 acres, and it applies to years on or after July 1, 2008. The main fiscal impact on this is included. It very clearly sort of shows what the real the important aspects of this bill are. Under current law, the amount that is granted to the Land Protection Fund is used as an insurance policy, and that policy is not to is used if a fire in any one spot exceeds $25,000. There can be some reimbursement to the fire district for up to a certain amount of money, but it comes out of the fund, and that balance is depleted by June 30th. It's anticipated to be about $173,000. So members or the landowners already know that they have to contribute to this fund, and they're in favor of this increase, so that they don't have to come back, let's say, during the interim and ask the treasurer or borrow money from the state treasurer in the event that the OLFP fund drops down below a certain threshold and can't meet its obligations. And so the revenue impact on this has been given to me actually by the state forester. They anticipate raising about $2.6 million from this.
Great. Charlie, questions for Mary. Charlie Stone, Mike. Mike. Thank you. And Christina McNett.
Good morning, Chair Deckert. My name is Charlie Stone. I'm a policy analyst for the Protection from Fire program with the Department of Forestry. As Mary has explained, the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund is the first tier in paying for emergency fire costs, and it's from 1991 to 2003, that was limited to up to $10 million, and this is all landowner revenues that go into this fund. Since 2003, in two-year increments, that limit has been raised to $15 million, and if House Bill 2067 passes this section, that would be extended for another 2 years with a limit of $15 million. The revenues annually into the fund typically are about $8.2 million, and that's been sufficient with the $10 million limitation on liability to ride out the good years and the bad years. With the $15 million limit, the fund's been going down, so the Emergency Fire Cost Committee requested this bill to increase the revenues from all sources at 25%. The bill would raise an additional $2 million and annual income would be about $10 million into the fund, which hopefully will ride out those highs and lows. The Emergency Fire Cost Committee does have the ability to request loans from the state treasurer. If that happens, they have to be paid back immediately in the next year, and the rates all have to be raised by the state forester to do that. But this bill tries to avoid the ups and downs of that type of behavior so that landowners can reasonably budget their costs over time. Thank you. Right. Any questions?
Questions for our Department of Forestry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I represent the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. We are the littles in the forest landowner community, but surprisingly enough, among the private landowners, we represent almost half of those landowners. I'm here before you kind of sending a mixed message on House Bill 3044. Ultimately, this bill increases taxes on landowners through five different funds. And ultimately, the Small Woodlands Association, we did support it on the House side, but I wanted to share with you that this bill is one of a number of bills that affect forest fire funding, and that it's part of an agreement, and that one piece of that agreement has a wrinkle in it in the Department of Forestry's budget. And I would ask this committee to pause in its consideration of this bill until we get that other wrinkle ironed out, and I'll explain a little bit further. The Forest Land Protection Fund, as explained to Mary, is funded by six taxes paid by landowners that go into the fund. It's the Forest Products Harvest Tax, which will be raised from 50 cents per thousand board feet to 62.5. There's an assessment for grazing that goes from 6 cents per acre to 7.5 cents per acre. There's an assessment for Eastern Oregon timber acres, which is currently 6 cents and also raises to 7.5. There's an assessment for Western Oregon timber acres at 4 cents an acre. That would raise to 5 cents. A minimum assessment for lots, currently $3 a lot, increases to $3.75. And a big one, particularly for my members, is the improved lot surcharge, currently at $38, an improvement to $47.50. This basically raises an additional $2 million into the Forest Land Protection Fund, as Charlie Stone explained. The reason that we need to increase the funds to the Forest Land Protection Fund is because landowners, in a complicated arrangement with the state, have agreed to assume more liability to pay for the deductible costs in the event of extraordinary fire, from $10 million to $15 million. The total deductible for the state insurance policy is $25 million. The landowners pay the first $15 million. The reason we've agreed to do that is because structured into that agreement was money for the severity funds, so we can get to early attack, and to purchase the state insurance policy, which I'll remind this committee, and I'm sure you know, insures the state general fund. It doesn't insure our trees. So the landowners pay that 50-50. But the bottom line, the base level on the base forest protection districts is also matched 50-50 with the state and landowners. And that's seen through the Department of Forestry's budget. At this point, there's a $3.6 million cost shift from the general fund to landowners on their base protection level budget. That needs to be resolved before we can continue to support increased fees. We're happy to increase the 25% in these revenues, and we've worked in conjunction with a number of partners, but we can't also stomach an 11% increase on our base fire protection district level. Our members, we're seeing conversion out of forest land base holdings between 22 and 26,000 acres a year. A lot of that has to do with different components, but one of those is the carrying capacity of that land from year to year, especially in eastern Oregon, where the value for that land far exceeds forest land. I mean, it's worth a lot more to do something other than grow trees. And with the Department of Forestry's budget in the shape that it's in, with the $3.6 million cost shift, basically increases the annual carrying capacity for that landowner through their county assessments every year to maintain that property. So this is a long-winded approach, but I just wanted to let you know some of the discussions that fire funding is complicated, as you know. There are a number of strings that need to be knitted together. We're happy to support this bill and the 25% increase to protect the general fund, but that's part of a negotiated agreement, and one piece of that agreement is out of kilter at this time. So if there's a chance that you could hold this bill in committee until we iron that out, a number of landowners would sincerely appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair Deckard, to members of the...
Senator Monroe. The other fee increases, this is the harvest fee increase that's in this bill. The other fee increases, are they in another bill somewhere? Or?
Mr. Chair and Senator Monroe, there are actually six tax increases in this bill before you right now, House Bill 3044. Yeah, there is another bill. You got to love Department of Forestry funding. No. No offense, Charlie, but there is another bill related to the harvest tax, House Bill 2115, which will also see increases on the landowner to pay for the administrative costs of the Department of Forestry, and that's a whole other issue. But at this point, if we can iron out the base budget for the Department of Forestry, I think we'll be fine and be able to support these increases on the landowners. But we can't increase these taxes while we have this 11% cost shift uncertainty ongoing.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Okay, so then the reason you want us to hold this is to make sure that the Department of Forestry budget is sufficient to hold up their share of the cost of fighting fires.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I couldn't have said it any better. That, in a nutshell, encaptures our concern.
Okay, thank you.
Mayor George.
Christina, you know, since this has one component of forest products harvest tax, are the growers on the east side finding the Department of Forestry a cooperator in making sure that we can manage those forests and make sure that we're in a less dangerous fire condition? Are we finding more cooperation now? Because what I'm worried about is we're doing a tax shift, taking away from what it really should be generated by us, which is harvest, and shifting onto other fixed taxes that you're going to pay. Do you find the Department of Forestry helping us to manage those forests for increased productivity?
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I'd actually say that among the combination of factors and participants in firefighting, that the Department of Forestry is a shining light in sometimes a dim and smoky situation. But it's a very expensive piece of light, and our Eastern Oregon landowners are suffering. It's very expensive. Part of the reason that we restructured the fire funding the way we did was to include, there are four components. There's the base budget in the Department of Forestry's budget. Then there's this for suppression. Then we have something called severity funds. And part of the reason that that's been so important and negotiated is because those allow heavy equipment, yellow metal, stuff to be put on standby, airplanes and helicopters primarily, so they can get to the high fire districts quickly, which typically are Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon, to get to initial attack and take care of those fires before they're bigger than 10 acres and more likely to get out of control. I hope that answers your question.
It's a perfect lead-in, if I could follow up. I think I talked to you about last year being in Orofino, Idaho, and a fire started, and we happened to be downtown. I've never seen anything like it. Everybody in that town got in something painted red or yellow and took off with a load of water. And the next morning, I'm in there at the Napa store getting ready to head back home, and I'm talking to this guy, and I said something about the fire and how quickly they got it out, and he said, yeah, we jump right on it. And I said, yeah, that was really impressive to watch it, because I was on top of a mountain looking across the canyon at how they were fighting the fire. And so he asked me the question. He said, where are you from anyway? And I said, Oregon. He said, oh, where you wait for the fire to get to be 30,000 acres. So I'm going to focus in on that idea of our preparedness to respond like what we saw in Idaho. Do you believe we're making that movement to that immediate response? And do you think that anything that's being proposed by the department would diminish the urgency type response?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think that the integrated fire program has been negotiated carefully with the Department of Forestry just to, for the express purpose of enhancing initial attack. I would say as a state, one of our significant challenges is that a large landowner is our federal government. And my members tell me, especially in Eastern Oregon, that that's one of the greatest liabilities they have as far as being a landowner, because the federal land managers handle fire differently, and you know, there is no insurance to recover the cost of your burned trees. For us, our option is to put those fires out quickly, and the federal government is a challenge. I think Charlie can speak to this a little bit. I know that the department has been working with the federal government on initial attack and on agreements. There's sort of a space. There's sort of this zone of space about who's on first in those types of fires, and the department's been working with the federal government, I think, has made quite a bit of headway in the last 3 years in being able to fight fire on federal land before it creeps onto private land and becomes our headache.
I wouldn't mind hearing a response on this, because I think this is such an important issue right now with what I believe we're facing for this summer.
Chair Deckard, Senator George, first of all, the comment from the man from Idaho, I hope that they can distinguish and understand the difference between the Department of Forestry and our federal partners there. What Christine is referring to, we've always had the ability to fight fires on each other's land in a kind of a common zone, and first the closest forces go and fight the fire immediately. I do believe the Department of Forestry's initial attack is very aggressive, but what's been going on in the last 3 years is we've actually negotiated agreements with the Forest Service that when a fire originates in a wilderness area or in an area that their firefighting policies and their management policies prevent them from being able to do the kind of attack on the fire that we want to see, then that extends their willingness to pay for the fire even when it crosses the line and comes to the private land. So it doesn't help us out necessarily on the ability to fight that fire more aggressively in the wilderness, but it has the federal agencies paying if we have to fight that fire on private lands after it crosses the line.
And that would only be appropriate that they would do that.
It started the agreement. They did that some on the Blossom Fire last year. We had a fire out over by Mitchell, another one up in the Cascades out of our Clackamas Marion District. And right from the get-go, any of the expenses paid by the Department of Forestry to fight those fires were reimbursed by the federal government.
Okay.
We're trying to get, can they uncall? Can we see if they can uncall us? Five.
Why don't we just go up there and let them get started, and then they're going to break for a caucus, and then we can come back.
I'm going to see if they know that we're down here. Let's just pick. They do know that we're down here.
Yeah.
Do they know how important the work is we're doing? Would you like to? Shoot.
I can just say quickly, ditto, and if you wanted to move the bill real quickly, I couldn't expand on anything more.
We don't want to move
the bill. Boy, yeah, you're...
not move the bill, but for the same suspension, excuse me.
We'll hold the bill over. You're...
Mike Dykstra with the Oregon Forest Industries Council, Director of Forest Protection.
And you're in Christina's
camp. I am.
Okay, so we'll hold the bill over. Close public hearing on House Bill 3044. And we'll come back and do the military department's bill, the boxing commission's bill, and the property, the retail store exemption bill momentarily, hopefully. We stand in recess.
When are we coming back?
House Bill 2023, and let's do 2026. Can we do them both together, the public hearing? Open a public hearing on 2023 and 2026. General Caldwell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Appreciate you giving us the opportunity to get these bills moved on today. House Bill 2023, basically, or do you want a staff report, sir?
Yes, please. Yes. Thank you for helping me.
Might make my job easier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
She'll be here longer than I will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and General Caldwell. House Bill 2023A modifies the military service requirements needed to qualify for a homestead property tax exemption to include members of the National Guard and military reservists who served 178 days or more under Title 10 for at least one day, if at least one of the days of service falls within the tax year in which the exemption is claimed, and permits a retroactive application for this exemption. A similar bill intended to do exactly this was passed during the 2005 session. There was some verbiage in it that we didn't pick up on, and as a result of that, very few of the applicants who would have qualified did not qualify in the current year. That is the purpose of the retroactive piece. Mm-hmm. And I can go through the details of why it didn't, why the language didn't fit before if you care to, but yes, Mr.
Chair.
This is almost one of those just slam dunk bills. Yes, Senator
Monroe. Yeah. Retroactive to how far back?
1 year, 2005.
Oh. Pick up.
Gotcha.
Great. Do you want to do 2026 too? Because I think.
Yeah, I do.
What's that? You're not doing 20?
I do.
Okay, we'll turn it over to the General Caldwell.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as your able staff indicated, this was the intention of the 2005 legislature was to offer a $60,000 tax assessment deduction from property taxes. It was we couldn't execute it. None of the soldiers who were deployed in the Guard or Reserve or title or active duty could execute on it because of the language, and it was just an oversight on how we were putting the bill together in 2005. In essence, what it is, your staff has indicated, this will fix it. It'll allow these people to go back and get what the legislature intended in 2005 and also carry it on to previous or ensuing years. The other aspect that was fixed is that in on the bill, line 12 and line 13, it also made some corrections as to the authority under the Emergency Management Assistance Compact. And what we learned in Katrina was that the federal government will step in, which was unbeknownst to us at that point, and put guardsmen on federal duty outside the state of Oregon, which had not been the case, nor was our understanding before. So that was a new wrinkle. So that's probably the newest wrinkle from the 2005. And that would be very untypical, I think, that we would have 178 days of that duty. But in case that should happen in a real calamity, then that opened that. We put that in there this time around as well. This is a good bill. This will do what the legislature intended, and we think it will get it fixed so folks will actually take advantage of what the intention was.
And does this get a – I'm just now remembering the situation, and I want to say Pendleton, Walla Walla, where we had a group of – and does this – solve that problem, and is that one of the reasons for the retroactive?
No, sir, Mr. Chairman, it does not. It was actually, we fixed that last session. That was the situation where we had a group of soldiers, same unit. Some of them were split off and put at Umatilla Army Depot. Some of them were over at Yakima Firing Center.
That's right.
And the ones at Umatilla Army Depot, by luck of the draw, ended up paying state taxes. The people across the river didn't. We fixed that last session, and that was actually a separate entity. It was similar but separate, and we did get
it
fixed.
Done.
It's done. We're fixed. They are happy. Everybody's pleased.
Great. Questions on 2023? Okay. Chris, do you want to do 2020? Are you doing 2020? Or Mazin? Or Chris has got 2026. Thank you, Mary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2026 also deals with a technical correction from last session that the Assembly thought they addressed, and it had to do with National Guard and Reservists performing active duty within Oregon. And last session in 2933, the intent was to exempt that from income, and the way it was handled in the language referred to service performed after a change in status from Title 32 to Title 10. And it turns out the reservists never serve under Title 32, so they never experienced that change in status. So the language from the 05 session did not apply to the reservists. So 2026 deletes that Title 32 to Title 10 language and replaces it with active duty service performed in Oregon that requires them to be overnight and away from home for 3 weeks. So it gets at that group. So this is a technical fix of what was intended to have been accomplished last session.
Questions for staff? House Bill 2026.
Mr. Chairman, I can't add any more to it other than we think this is a good fix, and this will help the reserve side of the House where the guard was pretty much taken care of last session because we are Title 32. Mm-hmm. Reservists aren't. And I think it's plain and simple, straightforward, and we support the bill.
And we're confident we got it.
Mr. Chairman, I think so. I think this actually came out from the interim committee because we had a lot of they had some testimony saying, you know, you took care of the guard, you didn't take care of me. Now, from my standpoint, I'm here to take care of the guard, but, you know, fair is fair. Uh-huh. And they should have got the same right, and we just didn't see it. We weren't smart enough to understand that in the Vote 5 session.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close public hearing on House Bill 2023. Close public hearing on House Bill 2026. Open up a work session on House Bill 2023. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2023A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 2023A engrossed to the floor with due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections. Order. Senator George, will you carry both of these bills?
Sure.
Open a work session on House Bill 2026. Senator
George. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2026 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 2026 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. Senator George will carry that one. Thank you.
Only easy ones.
Chris, open a public hearing on House Bill 2196. Madison, you really do. You get all the
fun bills.
You get the fun. Now you got the box. You can work in the De La Hoya Merriweather match into your staff measure summary.
Spectator sport, Mr. Chair. And if you thought the previous bills were slam dunks, this is an eye cap.
I like that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2196A comes to you from your counterpart on the House side. And let me just go briefly and tell you what we try to do in the House side, and that took a little while. The first of all, the tax, the boxing tax, as we call it, is about 6% tax that is set on statues on the gross revenues of events. However, it seems that with time, this tax has become, in many ways, primarily a funding mechanism for the boxing commission to regulate those functions. So in essence, it moved away from being the classic definition of a tax to a very painful and classic definition of a fee. Because it's a fee where it actually just pays for the regulation function of the commission. So we've researched this issue on the House side, Mr. Chair, and we did a few amendments. That's when it became an A. And what we have done is repealed ORS 463.370. And by doing so, that tax stopped from paying for any other thing or any other function outside the function of regulation. And by doing so, that requirement of a tax of a three-fifths majority requirement stopped being the case. So under that new definition, what we have, it is a fee that requires a simple majority rather than a three-fifths, and we moved it to a fee definition. Now, the original bill goes from a 6% tax to giving by rule the authority to the commission to go anywhere from 1 to 10% of the gross ticket sales in order for the commission to be able to do its regulation function of those events. That's what the bill is. That's what we've done. And with the revenue impact statement, as you see, this would be a regulation function. The amounts, because it's not determined until it's by rule, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of about 250,000 a biennium. Today we're talking about an average of about $83,000 a year, so this is what it is. And that's what took a little while in the House to get out until it comes to you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
So all of the revenue will now go to fund the commission.
The regulation function of the commission.
And do you know the current cost of the commission and approximately what that rate will be set at with this 1 to 10 float? Where do you think it'll actually go to fund the commission currently?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I think, and probably friends from the commission and the state police would be able to elaborate more, but the 1 to 10% is envisioned to be a layered type of fee, depending on the function itself and the event itself. So some events need more work and more coverage than others. So I think that's why they wanted the schedule to go from 1 to 10 and set by rules.
Yeah, but that's not my question. My question is, with this discretion, initially, where do you think that fee will go? It's currently at 6.
I think it probably would you know, on average, stays around you know, the 6 to 8, probably, something
in that neighborhood. All right, thank you.
Senators.
If I'm reading this right, according to the summary sheet, it says that it eliminates the transfer of the extra funds of child abuse and neglect. I'm shocked that there aren't people here. Am I misunderstanding?
Well, Mr. Senator George, this actually have not, although it's in the statute, right, and it's in previous statutes, and we traced it, then that would actually took a long time for us to trace back where that historical process has been, and there has not been a transfer to these accounts which were not easily identified then for five biennial. So this is not a major source or any source whatsoever for this function. It has just been old statutes basically that needed cleaning up, and that's what we've done with those.
Mr. Chairman, when we had the hearings on the Boxing and Wrestling Commission and actually got this thing back to where it should have been, because back in the old days in 1997, there weren't any events. One of the things that we looked forward to was the fact that with more events, which are occurring today, and with the better management of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission, that in fact it would yield money. Can you explain why it didn't do that? Because compared to, say, 1997, 98, 99, there has to be 20, 30 times the number of events occurring today.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, for the record, my name is Brad Darcy. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission. Senator George, the number of events for sure has grown exponentially, but I would qualify that, though, with the types of events have changed dramatically. We have seen a huge expansion into a different sport, mixed martial arts. Boxing has remained very flat. You know, we're averaging a few events a year, even with all the things you mentioned. Our work at trying to create a regulatory environment that is effective from a regulatory standpoint, but also conducive to commercial organizations being viable here. That difference in sporting activity has created a huge growth in our activity. We have, I don't know how much detail you want me to go into on the type of sport, but mixed martial arts has prompted, right now we're on pace for 2007 to have about 80 events. The thing, though, I would say on that, qualify that with, is they're very small events generally. They can range from a few hundred people to several thousand in the Rose Garden, you know, tens of thousands in the Rose Garden. So our revenues have been pretty almost dollar for dollar on our expenses at this point. We're trying to stay up with all the events. I currently have no staff, so it's a challenge with all those events. This last weekend, I believe we had four separate events going on, and a companion bill to this one grants us authority to actually roll into what we're currently regulating even additional events. Right now, the amateur events taking place in the states, and some of the other senators have heard of the bill on this, are not regulated. So Once we acquire that authority, our work scope expands even more. So this bill is at least one tool we want to have to be able to accommodate that expanded role and level of activity. Senator Monroe asked about where the rate might be. It's actually hard to say. I think Mr. Mazin is right. 7 or 8 right now at our current revenues would probably allow us to do the things we want to do, but I would actually also throw in that there may be a rate lower than that that could induce even more major promotions to come here to the state providing additional revenues so that we might net the dollars that we need to operate at even maybe a lower rate. So that's the flexibility on that range that we're establishing by this bill. Hopefully will give us latitude to continue meeting our charge and covering our expenses.
Mark Hemstreet, along with others, came in to testify back in those days when we were trying to get this thing under control. And one of the things that they pointed out was because of the regulatory authority for amateur events, it was very difficult to actually get the amateur boxing and wrestling going again. But what I understood you to say is that we don't have control over that any longer. We don't regulate that.
Well, I believe that the criticism of the commission in the past is was mostly tied to wrestling, especially entertainment wrestling. Mm-hmm. And to be blunt, we regulated wrestling out of this state for most of a decade, and that's probably what you're talking about. And we've made changes in our statutes on how we regulate that particular component of our responsibility to change. We basically reverse that. We have regular visits by major wrestling organizations, and so that particular thing we have corrected, and I think and that's positive. The amateur boxing is a little different animal in that the classic amateur boxing is generally regulated by USA Boxing. We don't cover that. That's a program primarily designed to develop our Olympic team and create the sport in its amateur component. Where we've not had the authority is on these amateur cage fights that are going on throughout the state. And while we do have the authority currently to regulate professional competitors in that sport, right now, I'd say 2/3 or 3/4 of those particular events are unregulated.
Is that bill coming? Because I'm with you. I think that's a very dangerous activity that's developing. It needs to be regulated.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, yes, that's Senate Bill 492, and it's on its way to the House floor.
So, Brad, with this, I'm in that camp. I don't want to have an incentive because of the fee to bring more of these cage fights and mixed martial arts where it's I don't want to provide an incentive, a revenue incentive for your commission to bring more and more of these type of cage fights to the state. And that, I guess that's the only fear of 2196.
Mr. Chairman, generally what we're trying to do is just give ourselves a tool to make sure that we can operate effectively. The number of events, you know, there could be an impact of this on that. It could drive it down if we do happen to raise the tax. I guess there's maybe a positive inherent pressure on the commission to, you know, set it at a rate where we do recover our expenses but not drive the commercial aspect away. By incentive, I only mean not to raise the number of events, but actually, I guess in a sense, the quality. There's some major worldwide promotions that would potentially, we're on a short list right now of potential jurisdictions within some of the major promotions that have been classically, you know, in terms of where they fall on the spectrum, well regulated. And the number of localized events would probably remain the same or maybe even go down if we were to raise the tax rate. But if we were to lower it, the number of events may stay flat, but our revenues actually could potentially go up enough so that we could collect enough revenue to operate.
Mr. Charlie?
Senator George.
There's such a dramatic change in the Boxing and Wrestling Commission. I mean, I'm ready to move this.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that
I would just say, just reiterate my, I would just hate to see this I've talked to you on the other bill.
Yes.
And the head of your commission. So you've heard me out on two issues. I just hate to see the commission use this as where we become one of the hubs of cage fights internationally. I just, my view is that's not what I think Oregon ought to. So I guess that's the only consternation I have.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Coming from the member, I think, that sponsored the bill to ban extreme fighting or...
The fight till you die.
Yeah. That was one of your bills, I remember.
So I don't, Brad, if you want to say anything about the current commission and the current directors feeling to about that.
Right. We have our responsibility, and the scope of that has shifted to accommodate these new sports, which are recognized nationally and are just exploding in popularity. In a way, boxing has its own history as well. It's the same kind of activity, although it's changed, of course, in its format. But our general premise for operation still remains the same. We're not necessarily, advocates for the sport or the commercial operators of these sports. Our role is to regulate them effectively so that the ones that are operating have to comply with health standards and rules. But I take note, of course, of the spectrum of opinions on these activities, and so do the promoters. They understand that regulation is really the only thing that's going to let them continue to do what they want to do, and effective regulation, more to the point. And so, I guess that's why we've not seen a large pushback on both of our bills. I think they recognize that, the sport does. And so.
Okay. Any other questions for this? Commissioner Darcy is the only one, or actually the Executive Director at RC is the only one we have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing, and I want to learn a little bit more about House Bill 2196 before we move that bill. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3537. Last bill. Mm-hmm. Hi, Mary.
Chair?
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3537 exempts from taxation real and personal property of retail stores owned by nonprofit entities if the retail stores deal exclusively in donated inventory and the proceeds of the store's sales are used to financially support a not-for-profit housing program. Under current law, these types of entities, retail stores that are owned by nonprofits, are allowed to take their inventory and sell it if the proceeds are donated to support a welfare program. But the definition of a welfare program does not include a housing, not-for-profit housing program. So this particular bill will extend that ability to have an exempt property on personal, on the inventories, the personal property, if the monies are used to help nonprofit housing programs. There are only six entities that I know of that the Department of Oregon, Department of Revenue has told me about that are located in the state that actually are currently taxed because they support, they use their proceeds, the sales, the profits or whatever. They're not profits, but they use the sales to fund nonprofit housing. And the impact is stated there, less than $50,000 in the current biennium.
Questions? Yes, Senator Monroe.
Mayor, do you have a list of what those entities are?
I don't have the new.
Is it like Goodwill and Salvation Army and people like that?
Yes, it'd be something like that, but I don't have the exact names. That would be confidential, Senator.
Okay.
I mean, I don't have the names. The Department of Revenue wouldn't release those names to me, but they did tell me they have six.
Okay.
Senator George.
The purpose of Dash 1 is just to pick up folks that have been impacted by the tax. And I'm looking at dash one amendments.
Who's here to testify on this bill? I don't have anyone signed up.
I don't have a dash one amendment. Oh, we do now.
Just the
yeah.
Okay.
And who drafted the dash ones?
Well, it's the speaker's bill, Mr. Chair. Maybe he's busy.
Just always kind of concerned to have bills that no one shows up to testify and
purpose of the dash one, Mr. Chair, would just simply make it have an impact in the 0708 fiscal year. So he's taking out the 2008 effective date.
Paul's mentioning that Representative Wisnett testified on the House side as one of the sponsors.
I would bet that one of these entities is from Central Oregon because we have Wisnett and Burley both on the bill.
Mm-hmm. Can you let them know that their bill is up and they want to? Yes, Senator George.
Would that double the numbers then that are in?
Yes, Senator Starr.
Okay.
It changes the effective date. That's all.
It would double the number of stores. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. Revenue impact.
Yes, Senator Starr. The 0709 impact would then be the same as the 0911.
Okay. Sure.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, it seems interesting if they wanted to make this a part of the 2007 year, you'd think they'd have done it that way over in the House. I wonder why they're coming up with this amendment to us.
Mm-hmm. And what, I mean, I before we just adopt it, I'd just like to know what the particular circumstances. I think Senator George's hunch is correct, but there's probably a few of them out there that like to get in. But with no one here to testify.
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't mind moving the bill without this amendment, but I'm not prepared to move on this amendment until I hear some justification for it.
What the problem is on this way. Okay. We did move 3048. Yeah, we've moved everyone except for 3044 and 2196. Paul, do you want to just tell us stories about your days at Washington State University? Get the projector. Yeah, let's load the projector. That would be good for when the Representative Wisnett walks in here that we're going to put a projector down. And,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Are we automatically excused from the floor?
I believe we were excused. I would imagine they're still caucusing, knowing the caucusing behaviors of our peers.
I think they're supposed to be out of caucus now.
Right about now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we could move the bill as is. We could wait for a moment to hear about the dash ones, or we could.
I suspect it was an oversight because some of the bills come in saying effective certain times when House members saw the revenue impact, seeing that there's nothing in the current year. That's when I covered and started, but it didn't come up during the.
Y'all don't care.
That's what I said. They're not yelling.
Yeah, I mean. You haven't seen.
Changes 2008 to 2007.
Just moves it back a year.
Who else can turn about money? Mm-hmm. That's why I asked the question.
Your property. We should have you at the mic so that we're not sitting here.
Somebody's watching. Wonder what to prove that we know what we're doing.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. Question for Mary. These are real dollars. Those are $22,000.
Those are the real dollars.
There's six stores mm-hmm. that we know of that. Well, they just they
We understand the interest that this legislature has in low-income housing, funding mm-hmm. low-income housing, and we're, and you may know there's a coalition and it includes some counties. So we are not resistant to this, and it looks like the revenue impact is fairly minimal compared to other bills that you folks have decided to pass. So.
Right. Representative Wesnett, we are waiting to please come up. We have not had a great deal of testing. This is our last bill we're doing. We just want to get a sense of House Bill 3537, the rationale briefly for it, and then just the dash ones, if they were, if your office might have prepared the dash ones, which just moved to 2007.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for hearing this bill. Yes, we prepared those so they would, the tax exemption would apply this year. That's what the amendment is for.
And Senator Burdick.
What is the reason the amendment didn't go in the House?
Just an oversight, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick.
The amendment was.
Identify
I'm sorry, Layla Estes, Legislative Assistant to Representative Jean Wisnett. The drafter of the bill just put in 2008 when she drafted it, and so it was pointed out in House Committee that the bill was that they would still have to pay this year, pay property taxes this year. So the amendment would just change that so they are exempted this year.
Well, follow up, if it was pointed out in House Committee, how come it didn't get put in the House Committee?
I believe the sentiment was that we would just get it out and correct it in the Senate.
And what problem does this solve?
Mr. Chair, that they would not pay taxes this year, this fiscal year.
Are there particular stores that were...
The bill was brought to us by the director of the Bend Habitat, the Bend Area Habitat, because they bought a new building, and when they bought the new building, they found out that they're subject to property tax, and that's why they drafted the bill. We're not sure exactly how many they are, but it would apply to all of them statewide.
Mm-hmm. Great. Senator George.
And any savings is going to go for the nonprofit housing program?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair. Senator George, yes, sir.
I'll just clarify real quick. The problem is other stores of this nature, like Goodwill and Salvation Army, they already get a property tax exemption, but because of the way that the ORS is written, technically Habitat restores, their resale stores, do not fall under this exemption. So when the Bend Area Habitat bought their house or bought their building, they realized they were assessed a property tax, and they didn't think that was exactly right. It was, you know, fair, given the treatment of the other stores of this nature, and so they brought us this problem, and Representative Wisnett, we worked with the Department of Revenue to draft this language, and here's the bill.
Great. Thank you.
This has been helpful. I had a lot of help from my assistant.
Well, this has been really helpful. We didn't have any testimony prior to your testimony, and this gives us great context.
I had prepared, but I thought you were going to try to do it fast, so I didn't go through the exact prepared that my assistant prepared for me.
Well, thank you for coming down on a moment's notice. Now, Olson, you've any other questions for the representative? He needs to. You're on the floor, correct?
Yes, sir.
We are too. So we want to go. Great. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for hearing it. I think it is a good thing. It's helping with affordable housing, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you very much.
Sounds like a really good bill. Now that we've heard.
And I won't mention the fact of who my co-sponsor is.
Yes.
Noticed.
Gil, yes.
Mr. Chair, the only Gil Riddell Association of Oregon Counties. I would like to ask if the amendments were prepared with the advice of the Department of Revenue or the assessor. I wish there were an assessor here because I don't, in terms of changing the dash one amendments is what I'm concerned about. Is it too compressed? Is there some extra bookkeeping that will have to take place if it applies to this immediate year? I would just like to have that checked. That's my only caution. And if the sponsor his assistant had the dash one amendments drafted under the advice of Department of Revenue, that would be helpful.
It sounds like they did it in the House, so that that at least gives me the assurance that it was out. The dash ones were out there.
I'm actually not.
Can I get your name again?
Oh, sorry, Layla Estes. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. It was just brought up in committee that this would not, you know, that they would have to pay taxes this year. One thing that might be interesting to note is that most restores don't pay taxes anyway. Most county assessors do not levy this tax, but the Department of Revenue has advised them that they should be paying taxes, so this just clarifies. I don't know. I don't know the answer to the question, so.
I think we'll. Tiny amount of. close the public hearing on House Bill 3537. Paul, do we have to do conflicts of interest? I'm on the Habitat Board of Directors for Portland. Do we do them in committee and on the floor, or?
In committee and on the floor.
Okay. Open a work session on. We're coming. We're done. House Bill 3537, Senator George.
Dash one amendments for
Senator George has moved the dash one amendments to 3537. Discussion. Objections. I declare a potential conflict of interest on the Habitat for Humanity's Board of Directors. Senator George.
Move House Bill 3537 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 3537 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. There we go. Oh, I've got a conflict. Senator Burdick, you want to?
Yeah.